I'm going to quote another one of my favorite Indian poets, Javed Akhtar. He's like a sixth, seventh generation poet in his family. And the question that was asked of him was that, you know, is this genetic or is this training? And the truth is, what you don't know is whether you are this way because those things happen to you, or whether those things happen to you because you are this way. So I don't know whether neuroinsight is the way this is because I am this way, or I am this way because neuroinsight is.
I'm Patrick J. McGinnis, and I coined the term FOMO. That's short for fear of missing out, and it's why some people end up following the crowd when they should be blazing a trail of their own. But if you want to achieve greatness in business and life, you've got to break free. Come on, I'll show you how. This is FOMO Sapiens, where we explore how entrepreneurial thinkers find the inspiration and the courage to build exceptional lives. Welcome back to another episode of FOMO Sapiens, the show for entrepreneurial thinkers. Today, I have a great entrepreneurial thinker for all of us to learn from. And also, actually, we're diving into the topic of thinking because my guest today is Pranav Yadav, who is the founder and CEO of NeuroInsight US, a pioneer and leader in the field of neuromarketing. Neuromarketing, which is basically like, why do ads work on us? What works? What doesn't? How do we figure it out? It's magic. Really interesting stuff that's going to make you think very differently about how you market the things that you market. Now, besides being the CEO and founder of NeuroInsight US, Pranav has had roles at Red Associates and Goldman Sachs. He's got all the unders. He's got Forbes 30 under 30. He's got an under 30 all-star alum. He's got Ad Age 40 under 40. All the unders. And he also has a passion for philosophy and Urdu and Punjabi poetry, which I have witnessed myself because besides just being a fantastic entrepreneurial thinker, Pranav's a friend and he has recited many a poetry and quote to me over the years and I've always learned something. So you're going to love this episode. He's a fantastic guy and let's jump right in. As you know, I ask every guest of this show the same question, even Pranav. So the question is this, tell me something unexpected you learned about yourself that changed everything.
You know, I used to think that I'm an out-and-out extrovert. I had trouble accepting the idea that I would no longer live with my best friend after college. That, you know, after the first few relationships when I was single, that I would have to live by myself. And that all the validation and the constant reassurance that comes from the world, that was something that I could live without. And then there came a time in my life where all of that, for one reason or another, disappeared. And to the extent that it actually pushed me to the edge, you know, making me question who I was and who I wanted to be. And the emergence out of it, finding out that I actually liked myself and I liked my own company. What I used to say about myself back in the day was that I'm not interesting enough for myself to spend time with, so I need others, and you know, finding out that I was interesting enough for myself was the unexpected thing that changed my life.
So it must be quite liberating, I have to imagine. You know, I think about people. Not that you were a person who couldn't be alone, but people who don't enjoy being alone, it's exhausting to constantly be generating, you know, time with other people. So in a sense, yeah, you must just feel much more free to do whatever the heck you want.
Yeah, it almost, you know, it pushes you in the other direction. You start enjoying it so much that you're suddenly, everybody is like, well, hang out with me, and you don't want to because you're enjoying time by yourself so much. But yes, it's, you know, there clearly, like everything in life, there has to be a balance. I just grew up in a way that, you know, I had an older sibling, and then I went to boarding school, shared the room with two other people, went to college, shared rooms, came to New York, had roommates, then had girlfriends. So, you know, never had to be alone and got used to it. But finding out this about myself was a healthy thing to bring into life.
All right. So we just started with an insight, and now we're going to go to a neuroinsight. See what I did there? So Pranav, thank you so much. I work hard for this. Pranav, let's get into it. So talk about the company that you are the CEO of, NeuroInsight. What is it that you do?
Sure. So it's based, you know, in a simple premise. And that premise is that the past 5,000 years of philosophy or the past 100 years of neuroscience tell you that 90% of all decision-making takes place in the subconscious. And by definition of the subconscious, it's sub, which means below, your conscious awareness. Now, take that fact and put it, you know, to the side for a second. Here's another fact. There's about $1 trillion that are spent every year on new product innovation, strategy, marketing, and advertising. Take that fact and keep it in the other pocket. Here's the third fact. Those $1 trillion that we invest in new product innovation, strategy, marketing, and advertising usually rely on self-reported data. What does that mean? It means that a company comes up with a new idea, does a focus group or a survey, puts a question in front of people, would you buy this product? People say yes or no, and they make a decision. Now, self-reported behavior correlates to in-market purchase behavior at a 24% level. What that means is that we're wasting $750 billion out of the $1 trillion that we actually spent on that stuff. And if it's hard for you to believe, you know, I understand that you do a lot of work in politics. Political polling is the most sophisticated form of surveying in the world. Mm. Because more money is spent on that because they have the resources available to do that. It's important. And yet, in the last American elections or Brexit, where you have had a 50-50% chance of getting it right, your polls told you exactly the opposite answer. So if that's how poorly polls can do, you know, when they're sophisticated, you can imagine, you know, what a creative idea or new product idea picking between 8 products that don't exist, those results are like. So that's the world right now. We spend a lot of money on these things and we have these old ancient tools. And the reason why, you know, there's only a 24% correlation is because the way our brains are structured is that, you know, all of this processing is subconscious. And when you ask people a question, the left hemisphere of the brain wakes up and is like, well, I'm the speech center. I'm also surrounded by reason. So let me evaluate this situation and circumstance and give you a reasonable answer for this situation.
So you're getting a shallow insight, basically, when you ask somebody versus something that's deeply embedded within their core.
Exactly. I won't even call it an insight. You're just basically getting a post-rationalized answer. You're getting an answer that sounds good to this person in the moment, but it has nothing to do with reality.
Okay, so how do you then take, you know, what's your approach that allows us to go deeper?
Yeah, so my company, NeuroInsight, invented a particular kind of brain mapping technology to look at the subconscious drivers of motivation. We bring people into a room. We stick electrodes on their heads like they're wearing a shower cap. We're looking at the second by second brain activity as they go through any experience. It could be watching, you know, a TV show with typical ad breaks. It could be an introduction to an idea, a new product, or a positioning or a strategy, you know, tools for political campaigning, what ideas are deeply resonating with people. As people go through these experiences, of course, with a large enough sample size, we begin to look at the second by second brain activity in different parts of the brain. And knowing which part of the brain does what, we correlate it back to different physiological measures, such as long-term memory, personal relevance, emotional intensity, and like or dislike. So we can see at a population or societal level what truly resonates with people, what are the deep unmet needs, and how do we actually begin to spot things that are actually influencing behavior.
This is amazing. Is this an electroencephalogram by chance, or is it something more fancy than that?
No, well, it's a variation on the traditional EEG, but I'm glad you can pronounce it.
Well, I had to learn how to say it in Portuguese because I gave a talk in Brazil. And the reason why I had to learn how to say electroencephalograma is that when you hook people up into an EEG and you show them images that are meant to provoke FOMO, there's a part of the brain that goes haywire. And so I had never heard of it. I mean, when I read that, I was like, oh, that's what Pranav does. Pranav, talk about, I know you do a lot of work, for example, with the Super Bowl, when these ads, people are putting big money to work for ads. Tell us about the kind of client that you work with, like a great example of a story of an ad that you've been a part of, or a product you've been a part of, and what you were able to learn and the insights you were able to generate.
Sure. So before we get into that, we're going to set the premise as to, you know, what is it that's the qualifier of a signal in the brain that leads to behavior change? Sure. And then we'll get into how you use that to look at creative storytelling and figuring out whether or not it's likely to do what it does or not. So traditionally, in the world of marketing and advertising, the myth was that it's emotion that works. And usually, you know, I set the story as like some, you know, old person with his feet up on the table, smoking a cigar, you know, probably passing other misogynistic comments, said something along the lines of, well, it's emotion that works. Mm. And then for the next 50 years, this industry has kind of followed that till we got the tools to be able to measure emotion. And we realized that there was no direct correlation between emotion and actual future purchase behavior. Hmm. And when you think about it, it is rather obvious, right? When your audience is listening to this podcast, they may like me or they may dislike me. That is emotion. They may laugh along with us. They may get sad with us if we get into deep things about life. That is emotion. That is happening in the moment. But whether or not they are going to talk about this tomorrow, the day after, or think about, you know, our discussions around the brain or creative storytelling a month from now or a year from now relies on one thing and one thing alone. And that is long-term memory. Now, emotion could be a driver of things into long-term memory, and it's an important driver into long-term memory, but it does not guarantee long-term memory. And there are other things that drive long-term memory, such as personal relevance, visual delight, excitement, and other things like that. FOMO.
Tudo bem, meus queridos FOMO sapiens? Now, that right there was Portuguese. And as you know, I love speaking foreign languages. But I'm not alone. One in five Americans have learned a new language on their bucket list. If that's you, make 2024 the year you finally check it off that list with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and delivered with conversation-based teaching so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. Now, FOMO sapiens, you know I speak four languages, and it takes work to stay on top of them, especially with French. C'est difficile. But with Babbel, I'm able to practice practical conversations that I can actually use in the real world. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/FOMO. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/FOMO. That's spelled BABBEL.com/FOMO. Rules and restrictions may apply.
FOMO. So, in the world of advertising, the entire purpose is for you to tell a story in the moment today, for you to take an action in the future, right? So think about like a car company who's, you know, advertising for a car. They don't expect you to go out and buy a car right now or press a button on your Instagram to buy a car. They hope that in a year from now, when you have the means and the desire to buy a car, this memory pops up in your head and you begin to go make that choice of exploring this car. That is the purpose of advertising and brand building. Now, Super Bowl, you know, on an average company spends about $15 million just trying to be able to air that ad once during the Super Bowl. Mm-hmm. Media buy is about $7 million. You know, people get celebrities and other big directors to do this. So net end up spending $10 to $15 million on that one 30-second piece of commercial. So the risk is high, and of course people want to make sure that it does create the impact that it does. So I think till about a couple of years ago, 20% of all Super Bowl advertising went through Neuro Insight. And the way it works is this: that either at a core creative idea level, or a storyboard or animatic level, or a finished film level. Our clients come to us, we look at their target audience, you know, stick electrodes on their heads, and they go through a naturalistic Super Bowl watching environment. And within that, this idea shows up, and we start looking at the second by second brain activity. And then we're able to advise whether or not this story is doing what it's supposed to do or not. And here's an example I can share with you. And this is from Anheuser-Busch. In 2014, they had this amazing ad called The Lost Puppy. And if you do not recall the ad, and for your audience, I'll just narrate to you what that ad was about. There's a barn where this gentleman lives. He has a bunch of Clydesdales, and he has this little puppy. One day, the puppy leaves the barn and gets lost. And the owner is worried about the puppy. And you hear suddenly, you know, the day ends and there's the sunset and things get dark. Music gets a little ominous. And this little puppy, you know, is trembling and worried. And then, you know, there's a bit of a thunder. And suddenly you see a pack of wolves in front of it. And suddenly puppy is even more scared. And then, you know, the music picks up because suddenly these Clydesdales come, you know, and all stand behind the puppy and the wolves are scared. They leave. And then they essentially escort the puppy home. The owner is ecstatic.
By the way, I'm loving this commercial already. If I had an EEG hooked up to me, it would be firing off.
Yes, exactly. And then, you know, the eventual reunion happens. Music comes to an end. You've known everything that's happened in the story. A red screen takes over. It tells you this was Budweiser. Now, this was rated to be the number one commercial in the Super Bowl that year. In fact, you know, one of the publications actually voted for it to be one of the top 30 commercials in the Super Bowl in the last 30 years. So clearly, the industry loves it. And the self-reported data also says that people love this creative. But there's a difference between a creative and an ad. And most people actually don't understand that difference. A creative, by definition, is a creative idea is connecting parts of your brain that may not have been connected before. And that euphoric connection is called creativity, and we all love it. An ad has an additional responsibility that when that creative connection is made and when memories are being created, your brand is present in the moment of that memory creation. Because otherwise, you've created just entertainment. And that is what was happening with this ad. You know, as this beautiful story was told, we've seen reactions that are in the 99th percentile of anything we'd ever tested. It was outstanding, much like you were describing, you know, that your brain would be firing right now. It was everybody, which is why this is such a popular piece of creative. But what they didn't realize is that the human brain is a pattern-seeking and storytelling device. And when you give it any signal that the story is about to come to an end, it essentially shuts off its memory doors for a second or two and processes and reorganizes that data. And if you have a key message or branding coming in that moment, you've actually lost your audience. So you may have done all the work to get to their memory till about that moment. But if you told them that the story is finished and then bring your branding forward, then you've kind of lost them. And in this case, the music, the red screen, the final reunion, all of these things were signals that they'd sent to the brain saying that the story is over. So they'd done all the hard work, they'd produced a fantastic creative, but actually it wasn't actually encoding any memories for Budweiser. Funnily, Budweiser came out into the market a few months later and years later saying that we've done these commercials and it doesn't help us sell any more beer. And it was us who, when we took that data to them at that time, when they were like, this is the first time someone's been able to explain to us why this doesn't work. So, and that's been our relationship with Anheuser-Busch for the past 7 or 8 years because of that commercial.
Wow. That's incredible. And you know, it kind of reminds me, it's advertising is an industry, much like publishing, for example, that it is, it's a business. Clearly it's a business, but there is also a deep creative element with creative folks who are very important in their work, but there is like this fight between the business and the creative control that happens. And if the business part doesn't get delivered by the creative, then you've just spent a lot of money on something that is beautiful but doesn't drive the business objectives. When you look at an ad like that, when you test something like that and it's not driving, are you able to then provide, a specific action to them to say, hey, you know what you need to do? The dog needs to drink a beer halfway through the commercial. That would be cute, but that's clearly, we can't do that.
Yeah.
What would be your advice to somebody like that?
Fantastic question. I think that's what, the industry had lacked before we actually came into the market was, one, they had blunt tools. And those blunt tools were actually just yay or nay tools. They weren't tools that told you what to do to make something better. And because, the fidelity of our data is so high, we're looking at the second by second brain response. We can isolate where the issue is. And given we isolated where the issue was here, what we can do is give people advice as to like, fine, a story is going to come to an end. So you're not going to be able to avoid that idea. What you can avoid is having the brand be present when the story is ending. So either you wait long enough for people to come right back and engage, or you actually come up a few seconds before the end and actually find where the moments of peak memory are, in which in this case, it was the puppy running into the arms of the owner. It was a moment that was creating this massive uptick in memory encoding, and our advice for them as they asked the same question. So what could we have done better? And the answer was, well, right as the puppy is running to the owner, you could have like a collar that says Budweiser. So it's not like an obvious branding moment, but your brand being present at the moment of that creation of memory would have solved for everything. That would have been it. Wow. So that's like small minor edits for you to be able to utilize the moments that have been created in memories, essentially lead to, future behavior. And by the way, our ancestors have known this for a few thousand years, right? I mean, I come from, we make the joke that my blonde hair and blue eyes are misleading. Most people think I'm from Sweden, but, in India, the Mahabharata was composed in 1500 BC, before even writing came around. And it was an oral tradition. And can you imagine that story is quoted directly in 2023 today? What is it that makes these stories last for long? It's not a religious story. It is just an interesting story. And what it is able to do, of course, there's a dharmic and karmic lesson within the story, but that's literally a page long. But this is the longest poem ever written in the history of mankind, talking about five different generations and kings and queens and a blind king who had to become king because his younger son, who was otherwise weak and died at a certain stage in his life, the ego of one party, the dedication of dharma of the other, an incarnation of Vishnu as Krishna, the greatest warrior in the world going through a midlife crisis, all of that shebang for what? To engage the audience, to get them to a moment of memory creation when they're invested in the story, and then deliver to them the actual crux of the matter. The Old Testament, similar format. The Odyssey, similar format. Like in every culture, these stories, the myths that we actually, told, we all know that they're not quote unquote reality. Yet at the same time, they do such a fantastic job at engaging the audience, and at the moment of memory creation, they throw in the moral of the story, which is just a remarkable form of storytelling, which exists despite, our brain mapping technology. That's how we exist. Our brain mapping technology just are able to recognize and read those patterns at a mass level that, were powers held by the masters, before this came around.
FOMO. FOMO. So Pranav, I have a question for you. You're, as much as you told us you're an introvert, you are you know, somebody that people enjoy listening to. You do a lot of talks. I always enjoy a good conversation with you. And I'm curious, given all the things you have learned at NeuroInsight, how do you apply those lessons into the way that you present yourself to the world?
I'm going to give you an answer that you won't like very much.
But
I'm gonna quote our friend Rumi here. There's this Rumi quote that says that you are not a part of the whole. You are the whole in a part. I'm gonna quote another one of my favorite Indian poets, Javed Akhtar, who says something along the lines. He's like a seventh generation poet in his family. And the question that was asked of him was that, you know, is this genetic or is this training? And the truth is, what you don't know is whether you are this way because those things happen to you, or whether those things happen to you because you are this way. So I don't know whether NeuroInsight is the way this is because I am this way, or I am this way because NeuroInsight is. But the concoction is solid. I think because I don't believe in consciously modifying behavior that way, I don't consciously apply the things that I learn into my everyday life, because otherwise I'd drive myself crazy. But I would be stupid to think that all of this learning that I sincerely believe in subconsciously does not impact how I end up being. So I'm sure it impacts behavior, but I don't know that I've consciously tried to apply it. I can talk about, you know, the key elements of creative storytelling according to NeuroInsight, mm-hmm. but many of my stories, you know, don't apply them at all, because that is the beauty of creativity. And because every time you make a rule, you know, around creativity, is no longer creative by definition, because it's a rule, and creativity will seek to break it.
That was strong. That was strong. I just like want to quote you on that. The minute you try to put a rule on creativity, creativity will break it. That is such a good point. I do want to ask you before we move into our flash round, our FOMO flash round of questions. I do want to ask you, though, you know, you talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, you give advice to people, people come to you for advice. We have a lot of people listening here who are aspiring or are currently entrepreneurs. You know, when you think about all of the things you've learned about how to reach an audience with a story that is memorable and really make an imprint, what would be, you know, sort of your advice to somebody who's saying, hey, I'm trying to figure out how to get people, you know, to pay attention to what I'm doing here?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite people in the world, my friend, philosopher and guide, John Zweig, says that, you know, there is a mystery within all of us that refuses to cooperate with linear and logical reasoning. All to say that there is a magic to authenticity and genuine human connection. And by the way, it's terrible that I'm even using this word authenticity, because it is completely corrupted.
It's totally ruined. I try to say genuine, but I agree with you. You see like the most inauthentic people using it. Now we're not putting that on you, but it's like, you'll see somebody who's like a reality television star talking about authenticity. So, but I understand the point is, even though somebody corrupted it, there is still something there. So please continue.
Yeah. And that there is so much more to what humans experience and react to than what you see on the surface. You'd see, you know, a touch by two different people on the same part of the arm. And in one case, it will seem like a reassuring touch. And in another case, it'll seem like a sleazy and creepy touch, because the intention behind it essentially defines how the counterparty perceived it. And you know, mm-hmm. and to an alien observer, they may be identical, but to a human experiencing that, they are not. They are very different touches. So what I'm trying to say to entrepreneurs as they tell their stories is that as long as there is honesty and commitment to the idea, and that you are not changing your rules on yourself every single day, as long as you've done the work to define who you are, both as a person and as a company, the messaging is consistent. It does work. It may not work at a time frame that most people begin to think it should work at, because that's another thing we corrupted. We corrupted an entire generation of entrepreneurs to get them to think that the only way to approach entrepreneurship is by being funded and artificially buying market share and growth in ways that the moment that money disappears, you don't know what to do with yourself. In fact, you know, it was the funniest thing to me when I first started my company. You walk into a room filled with entrepreneurs and they ask you, they don't ask you details about what the business does.
How much did you raise and from whom?
Exactly. How much did you raise from
whom?
How many people do you have?
So silly.
Exactly. So, so my message is that, you know, have that definition be clear. One of my favorite stories is a story from Nike. Back in the day, you know, I think someone gathered a bunch of people and asked people questions like, how many of you go running once a week? And a few people raised their hands. How many of you run three times a week? And fewer people raised their hands. And five times a week, even fewer people. And then like, how many of you who run five times a week would go running when it's raining? Then even fewer people raise their hands. And then the Nike guys go, well, we're the people under the lamppost holding an umbrella, cheering you on. That is who we are. And that is the market that I serve. And they have been that company ever since that they've been around. And they're still that company. And there's no doubt in anybody's head, internally or externally, that they are that company. And you know, you can watch documentaries, you can read books. It's never an easy path. We just begin to think that we must, the world owes us an answer quickly and a response quickly to, you know, our incredible inventions and our genius storytelling. But good things take time, and trust, which is one of the core fundamental drivers of behavior, takes time to build. And as long as we are committed to the idea, and if you leave your idea 2 years in because people are not responding to you, well, then you weren't supposed to be doing this in the first place. So my advice is to be genuine, honest with yourself, to the product and to the audience, and it usually works.
I love it. All right, we're moving on to our FOMO flash round. Now, that was some ancient wisdom right there. We all got to go back to, like, forget everything that happened the last 10 years and just go back, you know, and get some ancient wisdom on this stuff. I have four questions for you. I want a quick response. I want you to, like, just tell me the first thing on the top of your head, you know, as if I were an EEG machine reading your thoughts. Let's get going with the first question, which is, share a favorite quote or mantra.
To be open, fearless, and spontaneous to the rich unfolding of life.
All right. I love it. What's that from?
Is from my friend, philosopher, and guide, John Zweig.
There we go. John Zweig, twice in one episode. Number two, what is your most meaningful memory?
My mother singing to me. Oftentimes I, when I'm feeling insecure or I'm struggling with my own thoughts, that's the only thing that makes me feel safe and powerful. So my mother singing to me.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. Third, name a book or podcast that every FOMO sapiens should know about.
There's a book by this gentleman called Guru Charan Das. And the book is called The Difficulty of Being Good, The Subtle Art of Dharma. And I love that book because it revisits, this gentleman used to be the CEO of P&G in India, and wanted to understand Dharma, for which he wanted to read and write Sanskrit, came to University of Chicago, learned Sanskrit, reread the Mahabharata, had a degree in philosophy from Harvard to begin with, combined, you know, the Western philosophical analysis to this and created this book, which I think is an epic book to read.
All right. And final, what's one piece of advice you would give to your younger self?
I'd be like, tomorrow doesn't matter. You know, stop having your tomorrow ruin your today, because I did worry a lot about the future.
Yeah, that's a good one. I wish I had told myself that as well. All right, if you want to learn more about Pranav, you can check him out on LinkedIn. If you go over there, you can find him. His name there is Pranav Yadav, P-Y. That's what you have to look for. Or Pranav Yadav at NeuroInsight. Pranav Yadav, CEO of NeuroInsight, thank you so much for being here.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
FOMO. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me on Instagram at Patrick J. McGinnis, on Twitter at PJ McGinnis, and on the web at FOMOSapiens.com or PatrickMcGinnis.com, where you can get all kinds of free resources to live a more decisive and entrepreneurial life. FOMO Sapiens is recorded in New York City. Theme music is by Mike McGinnis, and editing and post-production is by Josh Elstro. If you like today's show, please be sure to rate it and recommend it to your friends. And as always, you can find me at FOMOSapiens.com and at PatrickMcGinnis.com. To advertise on FOMO Sapiens, reach out to contact@FOMOSapiens.com.